Evan Feigenbaum, thank you so much for being available to talk to us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
The latest gas deal between China and Russia that covers 30 years. Is it a major blow to the West, as Moscow claims?
Well, I think it's useful to step back a little bit and put it in the context of China-Russia relations, because that's a lot of what it's about. But that also has a lot to do with why they struck the deal now. I mean, if we're going to be intellectually honest about it, then these are two countries that are deeply ambivalent about American power and about the setup that has prevailed internationally since the end of the Cold War in 1991. And so I think it's certainly fair to say that both of these countries, Russia and China, are uncomfortable in various ways with American power and some of the specific choices and directions in American foreign policy. But it's also true that while they're uncomfortable with American power, they also have plenty of latent reasons to be deeply uncomfortable with one another. And so while the United States provides some of the glue that unites them in various tactical ways, it's frankly a little hard for me to get my head around the idea that there is some deep, abiding, and enduring strategic unity there that will persist in perpetuity. And you mentioned the gas deal, which I think is a very good illustration of what I'm saying. One big reason why I'm skeptical that there's some deep and abiding strategic unity there is that the relationship has become very asymmetric, with China now in the commanding position. And to see that, you can just look at this 30-year, $400 billion gas supply deal, which they just signed. It's worth noting, for example, that this deal took 10 years to negotiate. So why did it take 10 years, and why was it so hard? Well, I think the answer, at least as I see it, says a lot about the asymmetry in the China-Russia relationship. For one thing, China drove an extremely hard bargain on price. The Russians wanted prices that were closer to the price they get from Europeans. The Chinese presumably wanted prices that were much closer to the prices they pay to Central Asians. And while there's some ambiguity about the price level that was reached, it is clear that the Chinese drove a hard bargain and the Russian side basically gave in. So again, the asymmetry leans toward China. For another thing, China needs the gas, but not nearly as much as Russia needs the customer. At full capacity, the reports are that this gas supply agreement is for 38 billion cubic meters of gas. And it's worth noting that, first, that's not even China's biggest gas deal. The gas deal with Turkmenistan is larger, at least 40 billion cubic meters. And I think they've signed contracts that have been reported as high as 65 billion cubic meters. But China has other options as well, not just Turkmenistan, but Myanmar, Indonesia, Australia, and so on. So China has plenty of options. And if you actually think about that capacity, at full capacity of 38 billion cubic meters from Russia, which wouldn't happen for some time anyway, that's actually a small percentage of China's total current gas demand, which last year was somewhere between 170 and 200 billion cubic meters. So it's an increment. And by the time you got to full capacity at 38, it'll be an even smaller increment of China's total gas demand, which is going to grow because China's going to a much larger share of gas in its fuel mix. So again, China needs the gas, but not as much as Russia needs the customer. And so then there's the last point, which is the question of why after 10 years it just suddenly happened now? Why did it happen at this particular moment? And it's not just because Mr. Putin met with Mr. Xi, because after all, they've had plenty of chances to meet, and Mr. Xi has visited Moscow, so this could have happened before. So a lot of the answer to why I think it happened now has to do with Russia's current predicament, which has given Mr. Putin a very strong hand with countries around Russia's immediate periphery, but a rather weak hand with China and Mr. Xi. So Russia's under pressure from the West, and there's the simple economic fact that European gas demand is not going to keep pace with Chinese gas demand, and Europe is also looking for alternatives to Russian gas. So looking east is really Russia's only option.
And China will continue to buy gas from Central Asia too, right?
Not just Central Asia, but also from Australia, possibly from Indonesia, from Myanmar. China has a lot of gas supply options. You know, China, as you know, just from looking at pictures or reading the news, it's a very polluted country in terms of air pollution. And a lot of that is industrial pollution, not just cars, but industrial pollution. And so China very fundamentally is trying to change its fuel mix to reduce the reliance on coal, which is in the very high 60% of the fuel mix, to something a little bit lower. And the big winners in China's changing fuel mix are gas, natural gas, and nuclear power. And the big losers are coal and oil, which doesn't mean that China will cease to rely on coal and oil, but it means because gas is cleaner burning, there's a big effort underway in China to acquire gas. They want to take gas from 4% of the fuel mix to 8% of the fuel mix or higher. And what that means is they're going to have to import some of it. And so they're going around to all sorts of gas supply countries to do that.
We know that China is a major player in Central Asia. We know that it matters a lot for Central Asian countries, all five of them, to work and to cooperate with China. But how important is Central Asia in China's foreign policy? It's definitely not a priority.
Not a priority. I mean, it's important, but it's not the most important thing. I mean, when I think of the hierarchy of Chinese security and strategic priorities, number one by a wide margin is domestic security and perpetuation of the rule of the Communist Party. Number two is the East Asian littoral, so the maritime region that includes, you know, from stretching from Korea to Japan down through the South China Sea into Southeast Asia. And then in distant third place would be the continental periphery of China, Central Asia, and so on. So it's not unimportant. And, you know, Xi Jinping's been invoking these Silk Road metaphors that we've heard before from other countries, including the United States. And China has, of course, become much more active in Central Asia. But as a security priority, I think it's distinctly a third-tier priority. And notwithstanding, you know, what's been happening in Xinjiang, I don't think that's actually going to change. But, you know, China's come on. And actually, to go back to your first question, one might ask whether China's increasing profile in Central Asia is going to be something that Russia is simply comfortable about, because it seems to me that China is daily eroding everyone else's economic leverage, including, I think, Russia's, and incidentally empowering new elites in this region and in these countries who are invested both metaphorically and literally in China's presence. So there's plenty of Central Asian mistrust of China, as we all know and as we see. But China is a builder, a lender, a trader, an investor, and that has implications for everyone else. But their interests in Central Asia are focused either on resources, things like energy, and potentially agriculture as well, but mostly are derived from a domestic agenda, which is to assure stability in their Western regions, and also to anchor those Western regions in a web of cross-border economic interaction that would lead to development and be, from the perspective of Chinese leaders, stabilizing.
Well, we constantly hear here in Washington from the U.S. officials that America is not competing with China in Central Asia. It's not competing with Russia. Are they in any way, or is there enough political will, you think, here in Washington to do more than what it is doing now in Central Asia to, I guess, to counter Chinese actions?
Well, I mean, if you phrase it that way, America is not competing with Russia and China in Central Asia effectively, because it's hard to see how the United States can compete dollar for dollar with China, or chit of influence for chit of influence with either Russia or China. The United States doesn't do the kind of large-scale project finance that China does. It doesn't drop billions of dollars into state-backed loan guarantees that have state-owned enterprises that can be directed to invest. No, the United States not only isn't competing, but probably can't be competitive. And so I've always thought, both when I was in the government and since I've been in the government, that the United States needs not to think about it as apples and apples, but needs to think about it as apples and oranges. In other words, it has to necessarily and should try to offer something distinct to the countries of the region, whether it's connections to the global economy, or it's a different form of security cooperation, or it's political cooperation, or it's the English language, or educational opportunities, or other things. But if the idea is that the United States isn't competitive with China because it's not doing large-scale project finance through large state-owned enterprises, the U.S. will never be competitive that way. It just doesn't do it. So I think it's probably not helpful to think about it as such a direct comparison because the U.S. will always come out as the loser if you think about it that way.
You know, we see a very interesting trend, Mr. Feigenbaum, in Central Asia. You have a group of people. Specifically, I'm talking about young people because the region is very young. When you look at it now, the majority of the population in all countries are under the age of 35. And what you have is three groups of people: English speakers, pro-Western, Russian speakers, more or less pro-Russian, and then you have a growing number of Chinese speakers. And when you talk to them, they see the future very differently. You know, there is even a saying, well, if you want to stay, learn Chinese, but if you want to leave the region, then you should know English. How do you see this?
Well, that's true. I mean, people are learning English all over the world, though, and people are learning Chinese all over the world. You know, my sense is that what's particularly important for Central Asians and for Central Asian youth is to be educated in to be capable in a global language. There are wonderful languages and wonderful histories in Central Asia, but they're not international languages of business, commerce, diplomacy, science, and so on. So to speak Chinese, to speak English, to speak Russian, to speak German, to speak French gives one connections to the global economy in one or another dimension that helps to forge connections between those individuals, but also their countries and their economies. And so I think that's probably the more constructive way to think about it.
Young people actually see the growing influence of China in the region, and they see opportunities that come with knowing the language. So I guess what you're saying is that know all these major languages because they'll be helpful.
Well, no, I'm just saying, you know, you have a region that's been oriented to the north and to the west for a long time, but it's just a fact. The fastest growing economies in the world happen to be to the east, certainly not to the north. When the most dynamic economies are sitting to your east, it's not surprising that people would be looking to the east. You know, Central Asia is not the only region that's thinking about it that way. The United States is talking about rebalancing its foreign policy toward the Pacific. The government of India has been talking for years about looking east to the economies of Southeast Asia and to the strategic challenges and opportunities to the east. So, you know, the center of gravity in the global economy is in East Asia today. And so it's not surprising that ambitious young people of whatever nationality would want to tap into that.
When we talk to the officials in the region, they say something that you're saying too, that all three major players come with their own things. You know, each one of them is unique in their own ways. They come with their promises and problems.
There isn't competition, and geopolitics doesn't matter. It does. So, of course, the U.S. is competing with Russia and China, and Russia is competing with China and the United States, and China is competing with Russia and the United States in various ways. And let's not pretend either that the United States and China don't have large competitive aspects of their relationship. And as we see with Crimea and Ukraine, we shouldn't be naive or be under any illusions about the tensions and competitive aspects of what's happening between the U.S. and Russia and the West and Russia. Viewed from a Central Asian perspective, you know, China represents economic opportunity in ways that it doesn't seem to me very surprising that people want to tap and ride those growth stories.
Each country in Central Asia, too, use these three major players to sort of to play off each other, too.
Yeah, but I think, you know, you asked that very direct question about the United States and what it offers and whether it's got the political will to be active in the region. And I think that's an increasingly open question in a post-Afghanistan, post-2014 environment. I think there's going to be a big debate in the United States about exactly what its strategic interests are in the central landmass of Eurasia. And I think the U.S. has pretty abiding interest, but that's a debate that's going to play out here, not least because there are lots of pressures on American attention and foreign policy elsewhere.
We'll have a lot more discussions on this.
I'm sure we will. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.